Welcome to Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. Coming up on the programme this week,
I think times of stress and tension, whether individually for the person or whether collectively for, in this case, the world, tend to generate a search for meaning, right? So we interrogate the world in order to make sense of it.
So in our own minds, the truth is too mundane. It doesn't give us that sense of satisfaction, of self-empowerment that you've just described there, because it's the truth. It's out there. Everyone can see it.
What we did differently from lots of fact-checkers, news sites, they provide sort of suggestions on how to do that. And they always say, like, look at the source, like credibility of the source. You know, this very basic advice, of course, it's a good advice, but that's not enough.
And I'll be reminding you how you can make connections with mental health organisations within your community. It's Mental Health Monday.
Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.
Tackling the stigma.
Hi, my name's Mick Coyle. Welcome to another edition of Mental Health Monday. Now, it's a slightly different show this week. We are, as of this week, 6 months on since the original lockdown kicked in. And of course, that has played on people's minds in very different ways. And it's been about stress and anxiety and loneliness and isolation and uncertainty and all of those things. Things that we've reflected on through the programme in the last 6 months. But there's another aspect of this that I want to take a look at. I've been investigating coronavirus conspiracy theories and where they come from, how they emerge, and why it is that people sometimes choose to believe them. Because, of course, at the moment, there's so much information out there about coronavirus, and we're being told things all the time from the government, from your local council, from your local police, from Public Health England, or whichever body's overseeing your health at the moment, about how we need to look after ourselves, when our kids can go to school, when we should wash our hands. There's also something else that's going on. There are other voices in play, other voices trying to tell us there's something else that's going on, something which maybe means that coronavirus is a bit more sinister than that. Maybe it's part of a government plot. Maybe big business or big pharma are involved and they want to take advantage of us and take away our civil liberties. And not only are all governments in on it in every part of the world, but so are all the oppositions. And at the same time, so are all the mainstream media. It's an odd thing, isn't it, where you hear about these conspiracy theories. And I've got a webpage, which I'll put a link to on the bottom of the podcast feed, where you can click on and read some of those, so the top 10, if you like, conspiracy theories about coronavirus. And I think as much as anything, from the conversation I'm going to have this week with a couple of people, I can understand why people are looking for answers and looking for further explanations. And we come on to this in the first of the interviews we've got for this week's programme. This idea that actually the fact and reality around an outbreak like this, albeit extraordinary, the details of it are relatively mundane. And actually our minds are trying to find more interesting and exciting reasons for these things to happen. So I think this very much fits into a mental health world, because it's not just about the physical response of our bodies to coronavirus or the threat of coronavirus. It's how our minds adapt in the incredible circumstances we find ourselves in. So two guests. The second will be Dr. Elena Moosey, who's from the Department of Communications and Media at the University of Liverpool. Now, Dr. Elena is currently working on a project to try and make us fake news immune, a series of projects which will basically allow us, if we receive information about coronavirus or we read a rumour on the internet or your auntie, such a body, puts something on their Facebook page, we can understand and critically analyse that piece of information as whether or not it may be truth or fiction, false, a red flag, a whatever situation, hoax, conspiracy theory, or indeed the, you know, absolute right thing. She's working on that. You'll hear from Dr. Elena a little bit later on. First up, though, Professor of Clinical Psychology at the University of Liverpool, Peter Kinderman. Now, Professor Kinderman spoke to me about conspiracy theories. And I put it to him that conspiracy theories, of course, are absolutely nothing new, but it appeared that many of them had ramped up, if you like, during lockdown. Don't forget, I'll put the link to those conspiracy theories debunked through our website, and I'll put the link on the webpage that's hosting this particular podcast. But do check that out. It's really interesting to see how they came about. First up, Professor Kinderman, on why conspiracy theories have been so prevalent.
I think it's difficult to tell. I mean, one person's conspiracy theory is another person's takeover of government by an unelected cabal of right-wing idiots. Now, I personally think that our current government seem to be operating by an agenda to do the wrong thing most of the time. And I have a pretty clear suspicion that they're a bunch of over-promoted, incompetent old Etonians and their mates. Other people think that they're the new future of the Conservative Party and that we should do well to listen to their wise. You know, there's interpretations in all of these things. So some people are looking at coronavirus and asking where it came from, why governments didn't respond earlier, how we could possibly make sense of all of the information, and other people are seeing conspiracy theories floating around. I think it's a slightly dubious idea to label some ideas as conspiracy theories, other ideas as criminal conspiracies, other ideas as the truth. The truth, whether you're a medic or a scientist or a historian, is largely a matter of interpretation. I think something, I certainly believe that some things are true, other things I've got a bit more skepticism of. So I think times of stress and tension, whether individually for the person or whether collectively for, in this case, the world, tend to generate a search for meaning, right? So we interrogate the world in order to make sense of it. When things are particularly difficult, the meaning is elusive. So here we have a situation where we didn't have a global pandemic of a hitherto unknown virus a year ago, and now we do. In some senses, the explanation for that is so mundane as to be inadequate, you know? Viruses mutate. Most of the time they mutate benignly, sometimes they mutate and people die. Yeah, but we need more than that. We need a deeper, we need a more convincing explanation than that. It must be bioengineering in weapons labs. It must be deliberate incompetence by government. It must be an attempt by the government in order to subdue us into wearing masks when we don't need it. Must be. And sometimes the mundane explanations just aren't good enough. Our brains are brilliant at searching out and finding patterns. We can find the face of Jesus in a piece of burnt toast. We can hear, I can't remember what it was. There was something in a Rolling Stones song played backwards, wasn't there? Yeah. So our brains are brilliant at picking out patterns. When we're faced with a threat, and when that threat is difficult to understand, we continue to search for meaning, and sometimes we get it wrong.
If you, though, well, you know, were walking down the street and somebody said, what do you think of the weather today? Oh, it's okay. And they said, you know, I think it's a bit chilly. You might go, actually, yeah, it is a little bit chilly. You might change your mind. There seems to be something, though, in the conspiracy theories that people don't just believe them, but they then go very deep into their beliefs around them. And sometimes they can start to build their whole existence around a set of beliefs that aren't based on any fact or evidence.
But I think that's true of a lot of beliefs. So if we take political beliefs, it's quite unusual to find somebody who says, well, you know, I voted for Brexit, but I probably wouldn't do it again. I don't know. It's kind of, I'm on the cusp. People have strongly held political beliefs, and people get very passionate and people get very rude about politicians. Religious beliefs, I mean, there's an interesting phenomenon come out of people who've sort of moved beyond being atheists, because even to be an atheist says, you know, this concept of God, I reject it. And there are people, and I would count myself amongst them, who go, yeah, I don't believe that the world is made of butter. I don't believe that people have three heads. I'm not going to start listing all the things I don't believe in. And the resurrection of Jesus Christ is one of the 1,000 billion things that I don't happen to believe in. But we hold religious beliefs with such strong intensity. Why? Well, partly because they're about the structure of the world, what it means to be human, where we go after we die, the source of morality and so forth, but partly because it's about identity, about keeping us safe when, or a spurious sense, in my opinion, of keeping us safe when we go to sleep at night. We pack up our children in somebody else's car and we have to believe that they're safe. We need our beliefs to serve psychological functions. So when we look at conspiracy beliefs around the coronavirus, people and other conspiracy theorists, you know, that 9/11 was an inside job, that there are secret cabals of people running the country and so forth. Yes, of course, they have the quality of beliefs that people need to have for emotional reasons. But that's true of most of our beliefs, including, you know, the belief that our intimate partner is being faithful to us. We kind of need to believe that. We don't have much evidence. We need to believe it.
It's interesting when you've got, though, like there was one of the conspiracy theories was that there was already a vaccine for coronavirus, but it was being kept from us by people who were rich and powerful. Now, one of the people who shared that piece of information through her Instagram post was Madonna, who is worth more than $500 million. You would think that if, you know, the rich people did have access to it, then she might have been part of that club. Is there something in, there's a sense of safety in a world whereby there's no vaccine for this at the moment, and there's going to be quite some time before there is a vaccine. So it would be nice to believe that there is a vaccine. We can't have it yet, but it's nice to believe that it's out there, and there's some other reason why we can't have it, not that it actually doesn't exist at the moment.
Okay, so there's a number of strands to that. So one is lots of people believe in slightly outrageous beliefs, and again, that's true for human beliefs. Then there's the issue of Madonna's wealth and so forth. I think there's another strand to it, which is there's something curious about that particular type of conspiracy beliefs. So if I was to tell you that I have a particular secret that not many people seem to follow, that almost guarantees you a longer life, a happier life, and a healthier life, and would you like it? Because what it is doing at least 20 minutes of vigorous exercise every day.
Right.
And people go, yeah. What you want is you want a belief, you want an explanation for things which is curiously hidden from absolutely everybody. And yet not only do you know it, but if you look at the internet in a particular way, you too can find the evidence for it. So it seems to be something about, look, I have some wonderful information that can help people. Look at me. So it's about the conspiracy theorists seem to be often about coronavirus, 9/11, Davos, Soros, Donald Trump. If you look at it like this, you will see that I am giving you access to information that's hiding in plain sight and can give you another interpretation of the world. But it's not, there's some information that's completely hidden, because how could you possibly have a conspiracy theorist about it? It's about look at the world in a different way. But that draws people's attention to something rather different, which is I am one of the select few out there who has some very special information, which I will now increase my specialness in your eyes by giving you this information. You didn't realize until a few minutes ago that actually the Chinese had the vaccine already. But if you listen to me, I will give you this information. And that's rather different from, oh, I read a newspaper article and, you know, did you realize that exercise is really good for you? So the specialness of the information and the specialness of the way in which you find the information does something for my status in your eyes.
So in our own minds, the truth is too mundane. It doesn't give us that sense of satisfaction of self-empowerment that you've just described there, because it's the truth. It's out there. Everyone can see it.
So the truth is mundane and the story about the truth is mundane. If I said to you, hey, I looked up on Wikipedia and it turns out that the viruses are such simple organisms that you can't even really talking to about the viruses wanting to do anything. They're not even trying to reproduce. They're just little strands of chemistry that happen to reproduce under the right circumstances. There's no will, there's no desire. The virus isn't even trying to kill you. It's just a chemical. It's a strangely bundled little bit of chemical. And you know what? I found it on Wikipedia. You go, yeah, that's not terribly interesting. But a bioengineered Chinese weapon with an already existing vaccine that's designed to create a master race of people who will survive the pandemic Holocaust, that's interesting and it's different and it's special and it gives you. But I would maintain that one of the characteristics of these sorts of stories is that they're about the purposes that the beliefs serve rather than the status of the beliefs themselves in terms of the facts. And yeah, you know, life is very mundane. People are born because their parents happened to have sex, and they die because somebody didn't put the wheel nut back on properly. And here, you know, you're walking down the street, somebody sneezes, and a few days later you get a terrible chest infection and just die, because that's the way that chemistry goes. It's too mundane to be satisfactory. In the Restaurant at the End of the Universe, Douglas Adams' stories, somebody invented the idea of a total perspective vortex. When you could see how totally insignificant your life was, it was a terrifying and horrible punishment for people who have done some sort of terrible crime. And yeah, you know, the story behind the virus is probably horribly mundane. It's an unthinking bit of chemistry that may just kill our granny. And there's probably not a lot we can do about it.
Now, one of the things that we're lucky or unlucky to have in the 21st century and throughout coronavirus and plenty of time to be on it, social media. I think sometimes people try and engage with the conspiracy theorists, and that might be about something to do with coronavirus. It might be to do with a claim that the Earth is flat. And one of the questions I always think is a fascinating question to ask is, what would you need to see to not believe this conspiracy theory? So what would you have to show a flat earther so that they no longer believe that the Earth is flat, when there's no evidence at all that the Earth is flat? So what would, and they would say, there is nothing you could show me, including images from space, because they claim that they're doctors. There is, and you think, well, that's the belief in its strongest terms. When it's so embedded, it's almost not worth the fight to try and persuade them otherwise.
Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, if you're interested in fact, watching the sunset is a pretty good way of demonstrating that the Earth is not flat. But that aside, again, it's probably not about the facts. It's about the need, in some sense, to interpret the world in a particular way. I mean, my personal view about beliefs in flat Earth is I would not be terribly surprised if it turned out the people who believed in the flat Earth theory don't actually believe very strongly in the flat Earth theory. It serves other purposes, like rejecting science or being special and so forth. And I think that what I thought you were going to ask about sort of social media is why are people presenting? And of course, you know, I don't share on platforms like Instagram the really dull pictures. If somebody says, what have you done this week? I don't normally say, well, I didn't have a shave until lunchtime. I normally tell people about the interesting things that are happening in my life. And again, people share information on social media in order to make life interesting and possibly in order to make them interesting raconteurs, as people with access to special information. And that tends to fuel, I have special information. So, you know, if I was to say to you, like I said earlier, 20 minutes of exercise every day is really good. Not quite as interesting as, have you tried turmeric? Or even, you know, an exotic mandrake root, or even CBD oil. And it gets more and more technical, up to ketamine and stuff that requires an awful lot of technology. Mundane information isn't tagged as being particularly valuable, and therefore I, as the purveyor of mundane information, am not a valuable person. But Madonna, talking about a bioengineered weapon, big news, flash, engage my brain, do that. So I think the part of it is, again, we're not necessarily likely to convince people by presenting the facts. What we're more likely to do is to convince people to work out why is it that they're spreading this information and how do we repeat it. And in some ways, we've got to get people to have a little bit more faith in mundane information.
Well, the follow-up question I was going to ask you to social media was based around that. The idea that there used to be the pub bore who would sit in the corner and start rabbiting on about why Princess Diana, you know, really did die in that tunnel. And everyone would roll their eyes, listen, you know, out of politeness, and then ignore them and then not sit near them again in the future. Whereas on social media, you can put something like that on. And there's almost a sense now that other people will be looking for answers around why Princess Diana died. And they'll find the pub bore, but on an Instagram feed or a Facebook feed. And they'll go, finally, someone who can tell me the real story about what went on. And it almost legitimizes what's been said, yeah, because it's appeared in a social media feed.
Possibly. And I think, you know, the algorithms mean that you get fed this stuff, and the way in which you type in search terms. I mean, you know, if you type in government advice, keep safe, COVID-19, you'll get the information you already know. Why? Because the government's, well, Public Health England, not the government. The government is doing an awful job. Public Health England were doing a really good job. Public Health England has put out some really good information. Local authorities, even local GPs, are putting out good information. It's not hard to find good information. So we search for the more exotic information. And because it's exotic and different, it gives us a cachet. Okay. So yeah, we share this exotic information. But it's also true that the vast majority of people are absorbing the sensible information, are intelligent and wise about the world, and follow that. So most people probably, even if they think, well, maybe it is a bioengineered weapon, it's still a virus, and you go on Wikipedia and you go to Public Health England and you talk to your GP and you get straightforward and true information about viruses. We might be intrigued to read about Madonna and her slightly unusual views, but it probably won't alter the fact that we'll probably wash our hands after going to the supermarket. And more to the point, those people who do wash their hands after going to the supermarket are significantly more likely to live through this.
If you do become engaged in a conversation with a conspiracy theorist about COVID-19 or any of the other issues that we touched on, how do you respond, and how do you offer them that sense of, well, here's the reality, and show them a lot of very boring websites? It's often met with, well, Public Health England would want you to think that. Oh, you know, the politicians, I mean, they don't agree on virtually anything, but for some reason they've all agreed to tell a particular lie. And what's more, they've got the entire mainstream media on board with that lie as well. And you start hearing that side of thing, where it's, I think people call it the tin hat, you know, mentality, where everyone's against you. And even you, who I'm trying to share this important information with you, are denying that this is the truth.
So there's what I do and what I should do, right? So what I should do is go, ooh, that's interesting. Is this something that bothers you? And where did you hear that? And how do you make sense of that? And tell me a bit more about that. And okay, that's not quite exactly what I've heard. What I've heard is this, and how do you make sense of that? That's what I should do. And I should go, yeah, well, you know, obviously it's important to be aware of those possibilities, but, you know, I'm still putting my money on the fact that probably it's just a virus. And anyway, I'm still going to wash my hands. What I do is I go, dear God almighty, what on earth are you believing in? That's just crazy. But that's probably the wrong thing to do, because it tags it with interesting and different information. If you tag it with, so it's a little bit like when your young child goes, daddy's got a willy, very loudly, you go, yes, dear, not terribly interesting, let's move on with the shopping. And probably what we should do is go, yeah, my daughter does believe that. Personally, I don't think it makes a great deal of sense. I see it like this. Why does that engage you? What are your worries? Are you concerned about keeping safe? Do you have elderly relatives? Tell me a bit more about why you think that, and keep calm. But like I say, what I normally do is I go, dear God, you idiot, I thought you were a friend of mine. How could I possibly share a pint with somebody so obviously harebrained as that? Dear God, you'll be telling me that you voted Brexit next. And that's probably unwise.
And that's the flip side of this one, I think there's the alternative to the conspiracy theory is what you've just described, is the anti-conspiracy theory, where it's like, are you so idiotic that you can't see my truth? I'm refusing to view your truth, and you can't see my truth. So therefore, I think you're an idiot and you think I'm an idiot. And actually, by the end of it, neither of us are in a particularly good place.
Yeah, so we as human beings, this is not terribly sophisticated psychology, but we as human beings have to, every minute of the day, tease out the mundane from the extraordinary. So the extraordinary things are like, you're driving your car and you hear a tick, 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 and you think, is that something unusual that I need to pay extra attention to? Is that something that is demanding my attention and making me anxious because it's an indicator of a threat? Right. And, you know, if we walk into a room and one of the other people in the room is coughing, it is worth thinking, I don't particularly want to get an illness. I need to just be cautious about here. But equally, we don't want to go over the top. So we're always balancing what's the truth, what's the risks. We need to listen out for the unusual noises that indicate that something dodgy is going on. We just need to keep it in balance. If what we did is to say, oh, I'm sure it's okay, I'll carry on driving, and, you know, there are people who are suggesting that it doesn't matter if child refugees crossing the English Channel die by drowning because we want to turn them away. I think we should listen out for those sorts of voices. I think we should listen out for politicians whose parents were wealthy enough to send them to Eton, who have enough money to protect themselves from most of the bad things and calamities that happen to the rest of us, talking about herd immunity and employing people who have in print talked about eugenic policies to improve the gene stock of the country. Those things I'm worried about. I wouldn't say I'm a conspiracy theorist, but I'm keeping my ear open for things that really worry me about the direction of travel of Britain at the moment. And yet I'm sitting here talking to you about how other people have bizarre beliefs. So I think that mundane is good. Mundane, if you hear hooves, it's usually horses and rarely zebras. When I'm driving in my car and I hear tick, 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 it's usually my daughter playing a video in the back seat, but sometimes it's a nail in the tire. We need to keep watch out for these and talk about them. And of course, we as a species share gossip with each other. We talk to our friends and our neighbours and our relatives. We work out what's going on and we share information. But we tease out the truths from the fantasies. So here, I think people are worried. People have needs. They need to keep themselves safe. They also need to make themselves the centre of attention. They need to make sure that they and their friends are spotting trends that other people might miss. They need to be one step ahead of the majority, because sometimes tragedies creep up on us. We need to be alert for danger. All of these things make us prone to conspiracy theories. I think just sometimes they just get a little bit out of control. And like I say, my most favoured theory is that it's not so much about facts and more about the individual being at the centre of this web of conspiracy, that by their special knowledge, they've placed themselves at the centre of this complicated network of vital information, and that makes them very special.
Professor Peter Kinderman, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate you joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Professor Peter Kinderman from the University of Liverpool. We're going to speak to one of his colleagues now. I thought that was really interesting, by the way. I'm going to speak to one of his colleagues now, Dr. Elena Moussi from the Department of Communications and Media. At the start of the podcast, I told you that she was engaging in a new project to create this chatbot whereby you could almost get the sense of whether or not a story is true by typing into this chatbot and being challenged to ask questions about a piece of information, whether or not it could be true, whether or not it would be true, and whether or not we need to be a little bit more critical in our thinking. Because, of course, our response to the information we receive plays such a huge part, doesn't it, in our own mental health, in terms of how we feel about an environment, whether or not we're going to be anxious about it, whether it's going to stress us out, whether it's going to leave us, you know, lying in bed awake at night. I'm really hoping that this next idea really works. Dr. Elena told me about how it was all about helping people get their heads around the stories and working out which ones are true.
Yeah, well, I guess like right now in the current information ecosystem, a major issue is understanding like what fake news are. There are like so many definitions out there, and like, you know, the term fake news is basically an umbrella term, and you know, there have been like various also academic papers and studies like focusing on what lies under that definition. It could be like, you know, manipulation, it can be like satire, it can be propaganda, it can be advertising. So there are like so many different angles you have to deal with when you're dealing with misinformation. So what we did, and it was like, okay, we just want to work and focus on something that is gonna be useful and have an impact really. And so according to Reuters study, it seemed that, you know, 59% of fake news are actually not conspiracy theories or fabricating information, but are sort of like contain misleading content. And these can be of various types, right? So it could be like, yeah, you take like one aspect out of context, or you cherry pick some information, or you just make analogies which don't make much sense, or you generalize and blowing up like the results in one study, and so on and so forth. And, you know, in some cases, if you have conspiracy theories, of course, it's like intentional. So there's somebody who wants to weaponize like the information system for a goal that can be, you know, political, that can be instead of just, you know, social disruption or like provocation of any sort. Well, actually, there are also other cases where there's misinformation, but it's not intentional. You know, you might be a journalist who just has like that amount of information and you're trying to make your news appealing. And rhetorically, these can cause a misinformation ecosystem in a way.
So as a trained journalist, if I get, you know, a piece of information, a kernel of information, a tiny bit that maybe doesn't tell the full picture, it's my job as a trained professional to speak to an expert who can explain that particular piece of information, to find a second maybe cause of evidence, maybe to find other people who can back up the information. Whereas now it feels like so many decisions and ideas that we make about the news and what we've seen is based on not even one piece of information, but it's sometimes a headline, a Facebook post. And that, you know, we need to do a little bit more work, don't we, to find out more about a story, to say, well, I didn't read the article and I didn't ask anybody else. I just read that one piece of information and I've decided that that was what I wanted to hear.
Oh, yeah, I guess like here you're pointing to a confirmation bias, let's say, or this idea that basically, you know, we tend to take out of a piece of news whatever information sort of like, you know, aligns to what our beliefs already are. And this is, of course, you know, this is like human. And on the other side, epistemologically, though, is very... it's very potentially it's dangerous, because lots of, you know, for example, when you do false inductive type of reasoning, so let's say that out of like an entire piece of news you just like pick up those aspects that actually are similar, you know, to what you were already thinking, and then you just like blow them up, and so you generalize, and this is done. But you know, the problem is also that for journalists too, this situation is not easy. Because, you know, generally we say, well, journalists owe or like should or like should, you know, tell just like the truth or tell what's like the closest to the truth. But yeah, but it doesn't mean that if you should do that or if you should do that, you actually can. Because right now in the current situation, everything is like there's like a, you know, spread uncertainty. And we don't exactly know, not even scientists really knew, how this virus in lots of different ways it looks like, and you know, we had like inconsistent informations and results from scientific studies and trials that are hard to portray in a very objective manner.
So give us a sense of this then. If we want to be immune to fake news or semi-fake news, if we want that sense of immunity, what are those things that we need to know? What are those questions that we need to be asking when we see a piece of information? And that might be on a TV news bulletin, it might be in a radio bulletin, it might be in a newspaper, but it also might be on an internet page, it may well be on social media. What are those key things that we've got to bear in mind when a piece of information comes our way?
Yeah, so I guess like there are a few. So what we did differently from, you know, fact checkers, lots of fact checkers, news sites, they provide like sort of suggestions on how to do that. And they always say, like, look at the source, like credibility of the source. And I look at the image, does the image actually, you know, is taken out of context or not? And, you know, this very basic advice, of course, it's a good advice, but that's not enough at the moment to actually spot misinformation and not disinformation. So what we did, and actually, you know, we tested it through some data analysis, and we're also building an automatic fact checker is able to do that through NLP, is using like rhetorical theories from, you know, ancient philosophy to try to come up with a ballot, some, you know, ballot saying like, okay, you're going to ask yourself all these critical questions to try to understand whether the way you're reading the news is a good one, or whether actually you might be more skeptical towards the news. And so, you know, there are like structural aspects. First of all, is there like a standpoint such as like, you should not use or like buy any more ibuprofen? Okay, if there's that standpoint, are there any arguments there? Yes or no? Or do you think there might be, you know, other evidence that could be drawn that could actually bring to a different conclusion? For example, maybe there was another trial later on, and in this other trial, it turns out that instead, you know, patients with ibuprofen didn't have like bad consequences. And then there are instead also more logical, in a way, or like broad ways of presenting information that also we could look for. For example, are they comparing different situations, like the current like pandemic with, I don't know, the Spanish flu? Yeah, but is this comparison actually allowed or not? Or are they generalizing, saying that, yeah, you should, if you take a lot of vitamin C every day, you will not contract the virus? Is this coming up from what type of study? Like a study with a sample of like 10 people or, right? So we come up with a series of questions that we should all ask ourselves while we are reading news, and also with a series of questions that journalists should ask themselves while they are building news or like, so yeah.
Tell me about the chatbot that you're working on. As soon as I heard about that, I was thinking about almost like a RoboCop that declared sort of war on fake news, that would patrol the internet and get to the bottom of some of these stories. Doesn't quite work like that. Just tell us about how the chatbot will work.
Yeah, so the basic idea about the chatbot was that, generally we always say, through AI, there are like all these clickbaits and so on and so forth, and like, you know, conspiracy theories. And so we wanted to do a little bit the opposite. So we wanted to, let's use AI instead to help fighting like this misinformation and these issues. How are we gonna do that? Well, we can just like teach people how to be critical using a chatbot, because it's fun to do it in an interactive manner rather than having like a booklet and so on and so forth. So this chatbot, we're gonna have like two chatbots. One is for everyone, so for the citizens. The other one is set for like journalists and editorialists and so on and so forth. And the idea of this chatbot is that you're going to learn how to fact check. So basically you simulate a fact checking process that is actually though based on all these principles that we were talking about. And so you learn how to be reasonable while you're going through some news and talking to the bot. And it's not gonna be just like one agent in the bot, but multiple agents. So you're gonna, for example, have a chat with like Socrates and have a chat with like a bunch of other philosophers that are basically explaining you why, if they would be alive right now, they would probably read news in a different way from the way you would. The demo is almost there. So it's gonna be released quite soon, and we are really looking forward understanding, what's going to be like the feedback and the impact of that.
Red wine's a good example of this, isn't there? Where sometimes they say, make sure you drink a glass of red wine every single day. And then a year later they say, don't drink red wine, it'll give you cancer. And then a little bit later, then someone will tell you to drink more red wine. And they say the same about red meat. And then they say it's good for you, then it's bad for you. Butter, the same. Is that the sort of thing we'll be able to put into the chatbot that will give us a sense of where we can find out more information and let us make up our minds once and for all?
Yeah, definitely so. You could actually input any type of information. And, it could also, what would be clear in the case of the red wine is that if you had to think about, a group of people in front of you, all your neighbors, you would, through the chatbot, you would understand, if I actually think that I might have all my neighbors in front of me, probably it's clear that it would not make sense to tell to each of them to drink like a glass of like red wine. Because, one is a teenager, the other one is a kid, the other one is a mom, the other one is pregnant, the other one is 8 years old. So that's what critical thinking basically does, is that, you read the news and you're like, fine, but like, who's this person? The journalist doesn't know me. How can tell me like, hey, you should just like drink the red wine? Or even like the doctor is like quoting or the study. They don't have direct information about me. So actually, I should just like take a step back, think whether this applies to me too or not.
And you might not even like red wine in the first place, in which case you might say, can I drink white wine instead? That might be another question. When will the chatbot be up and running? When are you hoping to have it ready?
So the one for the public, so for everybody, most likely end of October, so quite soon. And then it's going to probably go through like a beta testing and then be released. And the one for journalists later in the year, but before May, probably.
Excellent stuff. Where can people find it? Where can people find the chat button and start having a little bit of fun with it?
Well, we do have a fake news immunity like website almost up and running. So we're going to post it there and probably also on some of the social media. So definitely all the updates are going to be provided on like the fake news immunity platform.
Well, I look forward to seeing it, both the public version, but also the version, the top secret version for journalists as well, which I will certainly share with my colleagues and make sure it's something that they're aware of as well. Dr. Elena, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate you joining us today. And thanks for speaking to us.
Thanks. Thank you so much. Have a great afternoon.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Thanks for checking out Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Mick Coyle. You can also find me, Mick Coyle, on Facebook as well. Don't forget, if you want to speak to somebody about your mental health, you can do so. The Samaritans, free to call on 116 123. You can find mental health services where you are. Just look for the Hub of Hope. Type in your postcode. It'll find those mental health services close to you. And for support in a crisis, you can text SHOUT to 85258. That's if you're experiencing a personal crisis, you're unable to cope and need support. Shout to 85258. That's a text line. Do get involved in those services. In an absolute emergency, always remember the number to call is 999. Thanks for downloading the podcast this week. We'll be back next week with more Mental Health Monday.